Hello and welcome to this episode of the Grow VC Everyone Funding Startups podcast. I'm your host, Marcus, and today we're talking to Michael Robertson, who's been a technology entrepreneur for many years in several companies and contexts. And we're also joined by Valdo from Grow VC. So first of all, welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you. Would you give a short introduction to yourself and to your background?
Well, I've been in the technology business for about, nearly 20 years. Most people know me as the founder and CEO of mp3.com. That was a digital music pioneer. It's a company I founded in the extra bedroom of my house and grew to 300 people and took it public. And at the time, we were the largest digital music company in the world. And eventually sold to the largest music company in the world, Vivendi Universal. So a lot of people know me in the digital music circles because of that company and a company I run today called MP3 Tunes. But I've actually done other companies as well. More recently, I sold Gizmo 5, which was a voice over IP company, to Google about a year and a half ago. Before that, I did a Linux company. So I've been involved in technology startups for, 15 plus years.
All right. And you mentioned founding mp3.com in your extra bedroom. So how did you first get started as an entrepreneur? Was it something you planned for, or was it more of a surprise?
Well, I grew up very poor, and I didn't like being poor. You know, being poor sucks. And when you grow up with, an empty refrigerator sometimes in your house and old clothes and, with holes and being embarrassed at school because you couldn't afford the yearbook and all of those sorts of things, there's two ways to respond. One is to say, well, that's the cards that were dealt to me and, it is what it is. I responded the other way, which is, hey, I'm going to do whatever it takes to not live like this in the future and to make a better life for me and my future family. So that's what I did. So from an early time, I knew in my head that I had to have my own company if I was going to do better than my parents. And so to me, it was easy math, right? It was easy a conclusion to reach that I had to start my own companies. And so right out of college, I began that path.
So you definitely had a good intrinsic motivator to get you started. When you first set up your company and started running that, did it go smoothly, or was was it more of a surprising career context in that way? Did you know what entrepreneurship was like before you started?
No, because, I didn't have parents that could teach me, and it's not something they teach in school, unfortunately. In school, they're telling you, oh, go work for the government, go do, work for a nonprofit and help the world and all this kind of stuff. And they don't really teach people how to work in a business or how to start a business for the most part. And so it is a lot of on-the-job learning. Right out of college, I started my first company, which was a computer consulting company. And that was going well, but as a consultant, there's only so many hours in a day, and you're charging people billing time, and so there's only so many hours in a day. So you really can't grow a single person consulting company well. So I decided, I'm going to write some software. So my next little venture was to write some software. I wrote something called Network Security Guard, which this was way back in the mid-90s. It would analyze a network and look for security vulnerabilities. At the time, you had to sort of explain to people why they should care about network security because it was so early. But I started to make more money from selling software. And selling software can grow large because you have a multiplier factor, right? You write the software one time and you can sell it a million times, unlike a consulting company. So I knew that was a business that made a lot more sense than a consulting company.
And you run several companies during your career. What have been some of the most central or focal learning points from your ventures?
Well, one of the interesting companies that I ran that was a good learning exercise was a company called Media Minds. Now, you've never heard of it because it was a colossal disaster. It was a huge failure. But if you're a smart individual, I think you'll actually learn more when you fail than when you succeed. What MediaMinds, what I was trying to do with MediaMinds was start a company. You know, I had seen my first digital camera. It was the Apple QuickTake. I don't know how long you guys have been around technology, but that was a big beast of a camera. It looked like a pair of binoculars, and it could store, you know, like 8 or 16 high-res images. And I put high-res in quotes because they were only 640 by 320, so even the high-res images were very low quality. But I looked at that, and I said, you know what? This is going to change photography. And so I'm going to go build some software that I think people will need, which is software that will manage their photo albums. And so that's what we did. Now, it sounds like a good concept, and people did need to manage their photos. And you know, of course, today, companies like Picasa and Flickr and, you know, others like Instapaper let you do that and have built, you know, substantial businesses around that. But back when I did it, it was too early. And because it was too early and because we had done desktop software when there was a slow shift to the web happening, we weren't successful. We were a failure. But that taught me a lot. And one of the things that it taught me is that in the type of businesses that I do, I'm always looking for a change in the industry, a change in the industry where the leaderboard can get reshuffled, where a new guy gets to sit at the table and can grow a business. And in those types of businesses, timing is everything. If you're too early, you fail. If you're too late, you fail. You have to get the timing just right. So what I learned from that failure was listen to the market. You know, it's not ready until consumers say it's ready. And so was I right that digital photography was going to change everything? Yes. Was I right that people wanted to manage their photos and share them with friends? Absolutely. But I was wrong on the timing. And if you're wrong on the timing in technology, you know, you can do everything else right and still lose. So I swore after that one to always be more sensitive to timing and listening to and watching what consumers are doing.
All right. I actually thought I'd flip the tables on this, since I know that Valda knows quite a lot about being early in the market. That's one of those things that I always tease you about as well. What do you think about being early in the market? Where is the right balance? And Valda, why don't you take this one?
Sure. Well, I guess that the first thing to do is to realize where you are at the positioning towards the market. Like you mentioned, I've been early a couple of times, spending all the money too quickly to try to build the market. So basically, one was only a few years too early, and the other one was, I think, was something like 6 years too early. It's difficult when you kind of see where the market is going, and then you expect things to, you have to, like, everything is like, you have to be quick on the market, you have to be fast and get it out there. But when you do that and you're too early, it doesn't really help either. So I think the most important thing is try to understand, first of all, whether you're early or whether you're late. If you're late, then and you're an entrepreneur that likes to build like really unique and new things, then I guess that's not the market to be involved anymore. But oftentimes it's also, even if you know you're early, it's very difficult to say how early. That's the most important thing to try to see where you are. And when you are early, try to pace yourself towards the market in the right manner, but at the same time be ready to scale quickly.
And one article that you, Michael, actually wrote last year that caught our eye in particular was an article on charity and the impact of charity. I remember this article quite well. And at GrowVC, we've been talking about getting the everyday person to support entrepreneurship and become a stakeholder in startups, and not in the form of charity, but rather in the form of small investments. So, Michael, do you see a difference in how people behave when it comes to charity, or then, for example, if they were more invested in, let's say, invested in startup companies in the form of very small sums, like $20s or these?
Well, what I see in the U.S. is a real bias that anything government-directed or charitable is good for society. And it sort of permeates every aspect of our system here in the United States. I'll give you a simple example. To graduate from high school in the United States, at least in California where I live, students have to volunteer time at a nonprofit. If they don't do that, they don't graduate. Now, I understand the motivation, right? That you want to make, you know, a society full of caring individuals. But it would serve those young people much better if they had to go actually work in a business where the majority of them will actually live their adult life in. If they had to work in a business, they would understand how free market capitalism works and how capitalism brings value to society. You know, if you're not making a product or a service that people are buying, you go away in capitalism. And that's the Darwinistic value of a capitalist society. In a government-driven or nonprofit, you know, maybe you're doing something of value, maybe you're not, but you don't have that profit, that sales feedback loop that's validating your idea as a good one or not. And so what I see in the U.S. is, you know, people will read my bio and they'll say, oh, we see you have an education foundation, because I do have an education foundation. And I'll say, oh, that's so great. And I say, really? Well, what about the companies I've created that have created 500 high-tech jobs? I mean, really well-paying jobs. Isn't that better than simply giving money away? Isn't that deliver more value to society? And I think the fact that I have to say that indicates that there's a real bias for nonprofits and charity and giving back, as they say, rather than starting a business. And I think that hurts capitalism in the long run, because people are not as appreciative, I think, of the value of free enterprise.
And Waldo, you've also lived in the U.S., and of course you have the European and maybe even a global perspective on things. So what is your take on this?
Well, I think that there's this, it's like in so many other things, that there, why does there need to be clearly defined lines between either it's this or either it's that? Or I have also worked in nonprofits or trying to help them develop their models and processes and things like that. And one thing that I try to build into that organization is that it needs to be, particularly when there's all kinds of partnerships and so on, it needs to also get its funding from somewhere. So all the kind of the partnerships and things like that needs to be run like a business, so that there is a profit sharing, there's things like that, even that the money then is only used for causes that are not generating money. So it's kind of a shame that or pity that those type of structures, it's either this or that, because then it kind of labels it so that there's a lot of people that don't want to go into work on non-profits if they are still building their careers in different ways or such. So I think that there would be opportunities somewhere in between as well.
I have to challenge you on that thought. And the notion here is that, listen, either the market determines your product or the organization does itself. In a non-profit, you don't have the market saying, you are not making a good product or service, go away. In a nonprofit, you have someone who decides, you know what, I think the world needs, you know, free glasses or something. And that's often a very admirable sounding mission. But ultimately, the thing that moves this world forward, the thing that has moved people from poverty to modern, advanced, high standard of living is one thing. It's capitalism. It's not charity. It's not government programs. It's capitalism. And so this notion that, well, we can mix them together, we'll have a nonprofit, but then it has to get profits. Well, then it's not a nonprofit, right? It's. I don't think you can have your cake and eat it too. Either you're a nonprofit and you live at the bequest of government taking tax money and giving it to you or donations, or you're a for-profit and you are accountable to the free market. And I think this notion that that you have to mix them together to do good is exactly what I'm talking about. Because, you know, I tell my boys, I have two boys, and I say, listen, if there's a company out there and they're making profit, then they're delivering value, guaranteed value to our society, because they're making a product or service that people are voluntarily entering into. And that is a concept that people do not grasp. They think, oh, nonprofits are making our society better because they're giving to the poor, or because they're making affordable lunches or whatever it is. And the for-profits, those are greedy companies. And I think in a lot of instances, the opposite is actually true. The companies that are making products that people want to buy and are voluntarily purchasing, those are the ones that are delivering real value to our society.
Yeah, I definitely agree on that point. My point was mostly about making these nonprofits to be more business-minded on what they do.
Well, that I definitely agree on that one, yeah.
And Michael, you highlighted one learning opportunity from your past, being too early in the market and then having to accept that at some point. What people often talk about in entrepreneurship is failure as a recognized learning opportunity, and how it's becoming maybe less stigmatized as something that you're not supposed to go through. But when you went through that process, what was the feedback from your peers like, and what was the overall experience of going through that learning process?
Well, I think having a failure like I did, it's very humbling, right? Because when you start a company, you go around and you tell your friends and your coworkers and potential investors and customers, hey, I'm building this great thing and it's so good and it's going to change the world and isn't it wonderful and it's exactly what everyone needs. And then there comes a day when you must concede that you are wrong, that for whatever reason, right, you didn't execute, you were too early, too late, whatever the reason is, you were wrong. And that's a very humbling process. But it's a good process, right? Because humility, I think, is a valuable personality trait. And after something like that happens, where you have a failure, I think it recalibrates you a little bit to be more open-minded and listen to others. And ultimately, that can be a very good thing. I will say this. I've often talked to about capitalism and entrepreneurship and things like that. And I've asked them often, you know, what makes the U.S. different? I mean, why are so many of the leading companies coming out of the U.S.? No, it's not because we're smarter, right? Our brains aren't, you know, genetically different than European brains. So it's not that we're smarter. What is it about the U.S.? And what they often say is, well, there isn't the fear of failure. And that's not what they say. What they say is that there isn't the stigma of failure. And they're absolutely right. In the United States, I can't think of many instances where people have failed and then been ostracized because of that. In fact, it's quite the opposite sometimes, right? Where there's a colossal, high-profile failure, and the person is very well recognized for that, and they come back and say, well, now I've learned, and now I'm smarter, and boy, that was a mistake because of X, Y, and Z, and I'm going to do better this time. And in the U.S., there just isn't the stigma of failing. If you fail, it by no means means you won't get another shot. It's almost, in some respects, a badge of honor. And it's a weird paradox, right? Because you're failing, you would think, how is that a badge of honor? But listen, there's a lot of things that go into building a business, raising capital, hiring a team, you know, building a product, marketing it, you know, et cetera. And if any one of those things goes wrong, the timing is another point, you can fail. And so sometimes the failures are out of your responsibility, and sometimes they're not. But in the United States, there seems to be this incredible forgiveness for failure that I think encourages people to try and try again.
All right, you also mentioned investors, and I wanted to touch on that briefly, as venture capitalists have indeed played a large role in your ventures. And you've raised venture capital money from several different investors in several different ventures. What have your experiences been like with investors as stakeholders?
Well, I've raised money for maybe half of the companies, raised outside money for about half the companies that I've started. And fortunate, and all my experiences have been great. But that's because those companies happen to be successes. You really can't measure your partners, if you know, investors or coworkers or whatever, until you go through a failure. You know, when you're succeeding, what I mean by this is when you're succeeding, everyone's a friend and everything is rosy. It's only when you fail do you really appreciate and can you really test to see how good of partners your investors are. But I've been very lucky that I've had very supportive venture capitalists. And, you know, I've taken a company public and I've taken venture loans. And so I've taken quite a bit of capital from outside parties. And I've been very fortunate. They've always been very reputable, good to work with, understanding of, you know, of my business and my expertise. And really sort of let me go too and said, hey, you know, go make us some money. They really have not tried to be heavy-handed in any way. So I have good things to say. One of the things that's a little frustrating though is I look at raising capital as being an art, not a science. And it's hard to raise capital. There's no individual formula. There's no, you know, perfect business plan or something like that. And quite often you see online people who say, you know, oh, well, here's the right formula and here's what you have to do. And you have to go get this board of advisors and then do this and then do this and then you raise money. And, you know, it's just not that way. It's a lot more instinctual, I think, than a lot of people want to admit.
And I thought at the end of this episode, Waldo, do you have some question that you'd like to ask Michael?
Yeah, actually, I have been following like several other entrepreneurs as well. I have been following Michael for several years on kind of different ventures through his blog and newsletters. So one thing that I wanted to ask, because I think you have also had a lot of situations where you have had to go on the court level on fighting against the bigger players in your space when you have started with the startup. And so what have you learned from those situations you have gone through?
That's a good question. I think the first thing to know is that when it comes to media companies, right, music, movies, you know, books, I guess, they use courts as a business strategy. You know, what I mean by this is that when you're reading the news online and you see a story about company A is sued by company B, inevitably your mind wants to say, well, company A must have done something wrong. You know, if that's why company B sued them, they must have, you know, done something wrong. Because normally that's what you talk about when you talk about a court case, right? When you're in a court case, you're talking about, well, somebody did something wrong. So there's almost this assumption that there's a moral wrongdoing of some sort when there's a court case. But I would contend that with media companies, that's not necessarily the case. That they use the court simply as a business strategy, simply as a way to slow down a potential competitor, to impede a threat. When you look at the technology history over the last decade plus, for digital music, which is where I've spent a lot of my time, you see the music companies have sued an enormous number of companies. And it's implausible to think that all of these companies were doing something incorrect, were doing something bad. And I remind people that the music companies who have, by the way, have sued me multiple times, you know, and they tell the court, oh, Your Honor, this guy's a terrible guy and he breaks the law and he doesn't care about the law and he doesn't think the laws apply to him. That's what they tell the judge. Of course, none of that is true, but they do that just to try to gain a bargaining leverage, a business upper hand. And I remind people that the music companies sued the first MP3 player as well. It was a case called Diamond Multimedia, and they wanted it outlawed. They said that's an illegal device. I went to court with those guys and helped defend that. And because of that, you know, we have our iPhones, our MP3 players, or Android phones today that can play digital music. So I like to tell that story because I don't think anyone, any, you know, average consumer thinks of an MP3 player as an illegal device, as a wrong device or a morally suspect device. But remember, that's not why they sue. They sue because they can force you to spend money. They can make partners not want to work with you, those sorts of things. And that is a harsh reality if you're going to start a company that competes with the media companies or threatens how they do business.
How do you respond to these big boys when they come after you with their courtrooms?
Well, I think there's several ways to respond. One is that you can just fold your tent and run away, and that's often what they want. The music companies have won many lawsuits by default because the companies agree to change their business and stop whatever they're doing that is upsetting the industry. Another path is to settle with the music industry. And I think of all of the settlements that I can remember, they have been disastrous for the company. You know, this is iMeme, iLike, MySpace Music. So many of these companies, they've settled. And because they've settled on very bad terms, they've kind of terminally poisoned their company's future. And you know why that happens, right? Because when you get sued, your board of directors will go, you know, what are you doing? This is terrible. You've got to get out of this lawsuit. And there's this big urgency because once you're sued, partners don't want to work with you. It's hard to raise more money. Your employees get bummed out, you know, thinking that they're going to shut it down and then all their hard work is worth nothing. It's very demoralizing. So there's a real push to settle. And unfortunately, the settlements that I've always heard about have been disastrous for the companies and ultimately led to their imminent demise. So that leaves only one other option, and that is fight them. Now, the downside of fighting is that court cases can go on for years and years. Right now with MP3 Tunes, which is a company that I'm running, which does personal cloud music, you know, we store all of your personal music in the cloud and then you can listen to it anywhere. We've been engaged in a lawsuit that's been going on for 4 years. 4 years. It's cost, you know, well more than $1 million to fight this. And that's a huge amount of money. You know, most startups don't have $1 million sitting around or more that they can use for their litigation budget. You know, you're scraping together all your money to build a product and to try to market the product. So that is while it's the, you know, while it may be an appealing option if you're an entrepreneur and a fighter, ultimately you've got the economic realities that come into play where you need a huge war chest because they will make it expensive for you intentionally. They will drag it out intentionally because if you run out of money, you lose. And it's a real shame that our legal process in the United States is this way, but it is in fact. And I think it's one reason that there's a lot fewer entrepreneurs in the digital, you know, media era. I mean, look at Google still fighting over YouTube with Viacom, and they've said they've spent tens of millions of dollars on that litigation, which is just an enormous amount of money. So there's no good path, right? Lawsuits make attorneys rich. They don't help build your business because even if you win the lawsuit, that doesn't mean you have customers. It just means that you have a permission slip from the courts. So all around, litigation is a very unpleasant experience and not a path that I would encourage anyone to go down. But if you're going to do something innovative with digital media, it's just a reality that you may likely encounter litigation.
All right. I think that's maybe a heavier question to conclude our episode on, but let's go with that for today. So thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure hearing about your experiences.
Thanks for having me.
And to our audience, thank you for joining us this week. Join us again next week.